kind of incremental and attritional violence and what that led to in the case of Grenfell. You know, we were in a situation where the Save Silchester campaign was based on saving our homes from being demolished in the same way Aylesbury. We saw the same thing they wanted to do in Haringey. You know, this absolute extension of global capital. You know, it's within a stone's throw of Roman Abramovich's £125 million mansion. It's in the stone's throw of Westfield. So essentially, it's quite inconvenient for the mantra of accumulation of capital as quick as possible for there to be a large area of social housing in this area. Within that logic that, you know, a lot of the old boy kind of Tory council have is the institution of social housing, and this is a direct quote from a specific figure on the council, embeds this empowerment and dependence on the state. So it's this kind of idea where, you know, neoliberalism converts what are human rights, whether it's housing, healthcare, or education, into privileges. And so that's what this is really a part of. We were active against the regeneration of Silchester campaign, and we viewed, actually, ironically and very sadly, Grenfell to be safe from that plan for regeneration because of the refurbishment that had taken place. Obviously, you know, the refurbishment was the nail in its coffin and made it unsafe in a million different ways that it was organised against. But the fact that the refurbishment had happened, we thought, okay, the rest of our houses will be demolished, but Grenfell won't be, so Grenfell won't be safe. Now, in kind of tragic inversion of events, what happened to Grenfell happened, and now the council conceded on the regeneration plan, though they're still keeping to the local plan, which was drawn up by Rockfield and Mellon to make 7,500 new homes, only around 1,000 of them affordable. How they're going to do that, I'm not really sure about. Would it be similar type of stuff that they did to Wellington Square, Port Bank Square, and stuff like these kind of situations. But basically, I wanted to talk on the re-regulation of building rules and the way that, you know, you had a situation where specifically one part of the building regulations, which is approved document B, which is how the government explained to people that they can meet the regulations. Now, during the Thatcher era, they became performance-based. So therefore, it wasn't conscriptive, it was based on performance. So it wasn't necessarily conscriptive about what materials you could use, it's just about how those materials perform, if that makes sense. So approved document B, Prescott approached it, and what they developed were these ambiguities whereby you have the construction companies now saying, as far as we understood it, the cladding only had to be class zero. So there's a specific test to meet class zero, and the insulation had to be limited combustibility. So what Prescott did during that period was really open up the opportunity for combustible materials to be used. And it also opened up something called desktop studies, which was particularly dangerous in the case of Grenfell, whereby you have, say, the cladding, which was Arconic Renovant brand. It had a polyethylene core, so it had 6 millimeters of polyethylene core, it had 0.6 millimeters of aluminium on the outside. Now, the way that you do the test for the class zero is it focuses on the surface. So the aluminium is not flammable, but the polyethylene was the equivalent of 30,000 liters of petrol on Grenfell. So you could get away with passing the cladding as class zero because it's just the surface, which is aluminium. The second part of it was RS5000 Celotex, which has since been taken off the market, obviously, and passed a BRE test. So the Building Research Establishment was privatized in 97, similar kind of period. And what that meant is that BRE, according to Sky News, not according to me, became partially reliant on investment from foam insulation companies. Now, the foam insulation companies, previous to the Kyoto Agreement, couldn't sell their wares in this way because they were dealing with stuff that was largely combustible. But after the Kyoto Agreement, there came the point where the British government were committed to lowering carbon emissions, and one of the ways to do that is to better insulate homes. So what that means is that the insulation companies like Celotex were literally boasting. Mark Warren, head of technical at Celotex, put a blog on their website saying, "Celotex now enters government." This is an exact quote, not a paraphrase. "We are now shaping building regulations to maximize benefits to our industry." They rented out a bright pink bus to go around the country, written on it, building regulations are changing. And so they were aware, there's been documents that have come out where they were talking about the change that is going to come to approve document B and what that would mean in terms of selling this installation. And so the point is, with desktop studies that was allowed by approved document B when Prescott changed it, was rather than you taking these two components, so the insulation and the cladding, and testing them together to work out how flammable they'd be, you could take the independent results of the test on the insulation and the independent results of the test of the cladding, and someone who's not an expert from those companies puts them together on a screen on a desktop and says, this should be okay. And Grenfell was passed off the back of a desktop study. The other point of the building regulations, which is massively important, is the role of BRE, in that when you go to them as a construction company to do a test on your material, you pay them £15,000 in Watford, this is, and you do the test yourself, and then you describe the test. So what happened was Celotex did the test and came out in January of this year saying, actually, we misdescribed the results of the test. So what was the reality of the test? Since it, the fire, it has been independently tested and it did not pass limited combustibility. Limited combustibility standards is 750 degrees burning for 2 hours. There's absolutely no way that that insulation would have resisted that. We saw it ourselves, you know, we saw what it did. So the point is that we've seen the penetration of regulatory bodies by captains of industry in a really major way. Now, what has this led to? This has led to a situation where you have 300 buildings, which are part of social housing in this country, that are wrapped in this stuff. Only 7 of them have begun to have them removed. If we go at this rate, it would take over 10 years for all of the stuff to be removed. The other important issue that this is a confluence of that has been touched on before is the role of local government within this kind of nexus. The local government becomes a conduit of corporate power. Now, we're in a situation specifically where leaseholders in Greenwich and Croydon, who are in buildings, Capital Quay in Greenwich, for example, they're in a building that is wrapped in this cladding, and they've been told, the leaseholders, that you have to pay £40,000. And in Liverpool too, I was not aware of that. And the leaseholders have been told you have to pay £40,000, you know, in Greenwich. In Croydon, they've been told you have to pay £30,000 service charge. So what we have seen is a media campaign, in some ways, to really isolate what happened in Grenfell and try and make this an issue which is not widely encompassing. You know, it's not just private buildings, and we don't know the extent to which they have it on, but it's also hotels, it's also schools, it's also hospitals. You know, these things have endangered the lives of children and ill people. And so local government in that way is literally serving as a tool of corporate power in that case. You know, in RBKC specifically on the issue of social housing in the borough in September 2016, took a payout of £33.4 million from construction companies in exchange for those construction companies escaping the requirement for affordable housing in the buildings that they're building. And so the point is that this is actually set by local government and national government, and local governments are using these ways of dealing with private companies all across the country. So private companies are coming and literally paying them to skirt the obligation to build affordable housing. So the results of this, in a situation where you have 1.2 million people on the waiting list for social housing in this country, you have 300,000 people according to Shelter homeless, you have 1 in 59 people in the capital homeless, you have literally more space in this country used for the building of golf courses than for the building of housing. 2% of the country is used for the building of golf courses, 2% of the country is used for building, and only 1% is used for housing, the rest of it is for other buildings. We see that there's a real systemic problem here. And so it's within this that you know, we see all this stuff. The last point that I just wanted to make, and the last issue that I feel it's a confluence of, is a culture of austerity and needless austerity, you know, within the context of RBKC, you know. But, you know, in London alone, you had £100 million cut from the fire service, you had 1,000 jobs cut, you had 10 fire stations closed, you had 29 fire engines taken out of service, you had the fire brigade funding in Chelsea and Kensington cut by 50% when fire deaths had gone up by 20%. You know, we all saw Boris Johnson saying, get stuffed. You know, these are violent policies that have violent repercussions in people's lives. It led to a situation where the fire brigade were coming into the building with walkie-talkies that didn't work. They had to get a ladder which came from Surrey. You know, they were in a really terrible situation that night. And so that's really where I would kind of like to take the conversation, is that, you know, it's these policies which are otherwise invisible and function in an attritional, incremental way that became visible that night and became, you know, a big spectacle of pain. And I think the extent to which we are able to build a successful campaign will be defined by our ability to make visible those things to people and also build a movement that is as widely encompassing as possible to make people see that, you know, this is a systemic problem which affects all of us.
Well, you've opened up a huge area, and I hope we will get back to this, but because of course the phrase that consecutive governments used was bonfire of red tape. Yeah. It's a phrase they don't use anymore. You know, it's a phrase that's got a very sick resonance now. I mean, I think those of us who follow this thought it always had a sick resonance, but of course it's got a particular resonance now. And what they meant by that was building regulations, cuts to fire regulations, cuts to workplace regulations, and the reduction of from 300 to 20 pages that Karim talked about actually happened across the board in industry, the withdrawal of ACOPS, the withdrawal of all standards. So that opens up a huge discussion about the politics of safety in what you described as neoliberalism, converting rights into privileges, because when there are privileges, of course, there are people who are dying. So thank you for opening that up. And Pilgrim, of course, opens up a whole economy of social housing, which we're going to get back into talking about, because it's absolutely crucial for you to touch on that. Joel is going to open up a new area for us, I think, because Joel is someone who has worked in local government and has seen the corruption at the core of some of the processes that we've talked about. And I regard him as an important voice in this, because he's forensic in his ability to uncover what's going on in the accounts, in the finances of local government. And so Joel's maybe not as well known as our other guests, but the information that he's been generating has been information about the way in which local authority finance has been restructured, government finance has been restructured to allow these things to happen, to allow a kind of faceless elite to destroy the basis of our social protection and reap the profit. So maybe, do you want to say something about that forensic approach you take to accounts?
Thanks, David. So I guess I'm coming here tonight as someone who's done a little bit of work around understanding some of the kind of processes that brought us to the Grenfell Tower fire. I'm a member of a research cooperative called Research for Action. So we're going to focus on social justice issues, the sorts of work which often is not otherwise funded or undertaken by mainstream journalists. So I guess last year when Grenfell Tower fire happened, as someone who worked within local government, my background is from New Zealand. I came to UK in 2008, so I guess my time here has coincided with the period of the financial crisis, the austerity that followed, and the fact that councils have been, local authorities have been the major recipient of government cuts. So I guess what I've observed over that decade has been these enormous cuts to council facilities, a huge loss of council staff, and particular issues around scrutiny of how decisions are made, how money is spent, and huge parts of that work just aren't funded anymore. So what we've created are a series of blind spots and gaps where people used to have a full picture of what went on, and that's now been taken away. So I quickly grasped, I guess, the significance of those trends we've heard about, so deregulation, privatization, and outsourcing responsibility, where you have these kind of opaque, long-winded supply chains, no one really knows who's responsible anymore, and the contribution those things all had to the fire in Grenfell. I also naturally sense to be a large extent of corruption involved. Many people suspect that there would be, you know, cover-ups both at the council level and at the Westminster level because of the ramifications of what happened and the fact that it exposed decades of failed government policy. And so I guess, yeah, the Grenfell Tower has become this very powerful symbol of an ideological obsession with cuts, deregulation, where we've tried to obscure cause and effect, and that effect being social murder of 73 people, as we've heard. So one of my favourite British writers is George Orwell, and Orwell once wrote, "The English have a world-famed hypocrisy. England is the most class-ridden country under the sun. There's a land of snobbery and privilege, ruled largely by the old and silly. Nowhere is this more true than the local government, where the average councillor is 60 years old. 96% of councillors are white, just 31% are female. The phrase pale, male and stale is never seemed more apt." And of course, this is still the same at Kensington and Chelsea Council. "Our communities are not well respected, not represented within local government." Orwell also said, "The most hateful of all names in the English ear is the phrase Mosey Parker." By this, Orwell meant the English are culturally conditioned to mind their own business, to not snoop, and to not question those in authority. Why is Kensington and Chelsea not using fire safe planning when they have £293 million sitting in reserves? But when you are ruled by the old and the silly, corrupt power only persists if the lower rungs of society are socialised not to ask questions, to not be nosy parkers. What that nosy parker culture creates is an environment which is extremely conducive to fraud and to corruption. In the military, it's known as don't ask, don't tell. In the mafia, as omerta. And in the City of London, nod, nod, wink, wink. Fat bonuses and non-disclosure agreements that people never speak out. Most Tory MPs now come from the city, like Sajid Javid, the former local government minister. The result is a particularly British phenomenon where a country which is the undisputed centre of global money laundering and financial fraud simultaneously holds itself up as moral and refined, a bastion of global democracy, despite ample evidence to the contrary. Being a freelance journalist and researcher, I spend a lot of my time sending information requests to local authorities, being a nosy parker. I've never been a stickler for rules I don't respect or view as unjust, and because of that, I've been labelled vexatious by local authorities just for asking questions in public interest. Shortly after the Grenfell fire, through connections and a random series of events, Lily Allen invited myself and a friend to look around the Grenfell area, to get a feel for what's happening on the ground and to start investigating the local council and witness the community's response. We went down to the council and requested Grenfell Tower for documents, so things like invoices, contracts, where the council spent money on fire risk assessments, look at the state of the building. And we refused access to these documents on the basis they were commercially sensitive. So again, kind of commercial interests trumping public interests. My colleague, Fanny Madeline, sent FOIs to the council that remained unanswered months later, prompting a warning by the Information Commissioner who was supposed to police that space. Having previously researched Kensington and Chelsea as a hotbed of neoliberal municipal finance, I already knew some of the faces involved in the decision-making that led to the deaths of these 72 people. Those people are Sir Murek Cockle, the former leader of Kensington and Chelsea Council, and the former head of the Local Government Association, and Tom Fairhead, who was previously a member of finance at RBKC and is also the husband of HSBC banker and former BBC Trust boss, Rona Fairhead. In response to Grenfell, working with people like David White, Leeds-based academics Megan Moore and Stuart Hodkinson, Research for Action submitted evidence to the public inquiry, and some of the findings were absolutely shocking. RBKC, led by Cockle and Fairhead, engaged in a deliberate five-year policy of council tax cuts, where rebates were given to wealthy residents, which they framed as an efficiency dividend. So what they were saying is, the council's so good at not spending public money on poor people, we're going to give lots of money back to rich people in the borough. Despite savage central government austerity, Kensington and Chelsea decided unnecessarily to take more money away from frontline services used by the poorest in the borough, and to return this money to the wealthiest, to spend in luxury shops. Over this period of about 10 years, from 2008-09 through to this year, Kensington's own income from council tax fell by £125 million because of this policy. That's enough money to pay for the full Grenfell Tower refurbishment, about 10 times over. Since the Tories came to power in 2010, the life expectancy of the poorest residents in RBKC has reduced by 6 years. The gap in life expectancy between the richest and poorest in the borough is 22 years. So it's not just in Grenfell Tower where residents of the Royal Borough have been killed prematurely by Conservative policies. Contempt for the poor and failure to serve the public interest are commonplace. And I'd point to people like Sajid Javid and Gavin Barwell in particularly cultivated. So I'll leave it there and just pass back to you. Please.
Thanks very much, Joel. I mean, you listen to that and you begin to think that there's something else going on which isn't just about the immediate cost savings, it's not about austerity, there's a much bigger project to demonise a community because there's much bigger profits at stake in a very kind of simplified way. And I know, I think I'll bring you in a minute, Tasha, if that's okay, to maybe talk about the way the community's been demonised, but I know that you know a bit about the history of that area. You might or might not want to talk about that program, but also generally that's something that's going on in London. The demonisation of communities to make them ripe for exploitation or slum clearance or whatever label they put on it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we've seen since Thatcherism, the way you put it earlier on, the transformation of rights into privileges, and the purpose of demonising particular sections of the community. And that is what was once a completely working class community, but since industry has changed and our economic structure has changed, more and more of those people are now not working, and have been dependent to some degree on state support, both in terms of welfare and in terms of social housing. And we've seen that over a long, long period of time, and then very, very intensely in London, which is, you know, what I know about, the idea of moving out these communities, moving out dependent communities, and you'll see that being spoken about differently by different types of politicians. So whereas in Barnet, which is a Tory area, well, it is until today, and we'll see, and it'll be interesting to see what changes, depending on what happens tomorrow, because quite a lot could change. But in Barnet, for instance, very right-wing council, but with, again, a large working class community there. And I think similar things have been said in Kensington and Chelsea, that politicians have explicitly got off and said in the council chamber in debates, we do not want people here who are draining resources from us. We do not want council tax benefit recipients. We want council tax payers. And these people are a drain on the state. Now, social housing has never been a drain on the state. It's paid for itself. It's described as being a drain on the state. It's described as being subsidised. But over a long period, social housing in terms of the input costs have been covered afterwards by rent And that's actually quite interesting. What happened at Grenfell is that it turned out that, in fact, they had made a huge amount of profit from rent that was never reinvested into the maintenance of that building. But underlying all of this has been 40 years of international financial deregulation and the ability to make profit from areas which you previously couldn't make profit from, such as social housing. Now, the cost of housing is driven not so much by the building itself, but by the land on which it sits on. And to be able to realise that the value of that land, you had to deregulate international financial mortgage markets and so on. And that has been the driving force of what we have seen is a really massive demographic changes, I think, and it will be interesting to see whether they still do the census in the same way in 2021, I think, is when it's due, because if they're still asking the same questions, we will see a change in London's population, moving from being a working class, moving away from being more working class communities here, and having expelled so many working class people from our capital, simply for profit. And I think that kind of explains, I live in an area called Lambeth in South London, and formerly that's a Labour borough. It's a very new Labour borough. And that council are not responsive to their working class residents. That council is completely supportive of driving through regeneration. A number of those councillors work for PR companies that represent private property developers, or planning consultancies. And I think we have to, and hopefully Grenfell has sparked that we have to organise our communities, and we have to start empowering ourselves, and we have to start challenging these forces, because, you know, I will keep talking about London, but I can see it changing, and I can see it not being the area I knew 10 years ago, and 10 years before that, and 10 years before that. And that's very, very, very unpleasant. And I can see those inequalities growing, you know, and that's not the kind of place I want to live in. But I think after Grenfell that we are much more aware of it, and much more aware of the consequences, both of the slow, drawn-out destruction of life, or that very harsh violence incidents that can happen from living under a system whose priority is profits, absolutely and only profits, and absolutely not people.
I mean, if we kind of connecting some of the big fires, and you talked about the financialisation there. 40% of London's property market now is owned by financial flows that come from tax havens, from secrecy jurisdictions. We don't even know who owns them. All we know is that it's predatory. It's preying on an easy market that can get rid of people very easily. And we know that that relies on the demonisation of those spaces, the demonisation of those areas, the way that ordinary people are described living in those areas. And I want to kind of shift this a little bit, because I know that you've got something to say, Tasha, about the way that even after Grenfell, the way the press has been demonised. I mean, there's two issues, really. You know, I know that you as an organisation have been demonised, but the area itself is also being demonised for particular reasons. And of course, I'll bring you in a minute if you need to talk about that. But maybe you could say something about that.
Yeah, wow, I sound loud. I think, well, first of all, I didn't realise I was poor until the media told me I was poor. I knew that I was maybe not as affluent as the south side of the borough, but I never thought of myself as poor. I didn't think of my neighbours as poor, but the media have drummed it into my head every single day since the fire that I come from a poor, troubled area in London, in the north, and we all keep together and we rob each other and stuff. We don't. So I didn't realise that. And yes, on a month after the fire, the Telegraph came after the campaign. They named someone who I don't think anyone in the campaign had even met as being on the campaign. They've constantly gone for every single fraud case that has come out of Grenfell, which, okay, these people have committed a crime, but they didn't burn 72 people to death in their homes. I think the danger with those fraud cases as well is that people reading these stories sometimes will associate, okay, these people grumble, and then you're basically just saying a whole entire block of people were criminals. And no, these people have done a fraudulent thing and said they lived in Grenfell Tower. They didn't live in Grenfell Tower, so they shouldn't be associated with Grenfell Tower. And it's just another way that we're kind of portrayed. As Karim will know, Reggie, I don't know if anyone saw the Reggie Yates documentary a few weeks ago, which started off as a pretty good documentary telling the lives of normal people, and then there was a moment where it switched, and the Reggie said, oh, and through my investigations, I found out that 17 people who died in the tower were originally from a small town in Morocco that's known for illegal immigration. And that came from nowhere. It came from absolutely, you're like, what? Where did that come from? And that's just another way that the media, and it was the BBC, and I think the BBC are quite happy to do this, but they will demonise us and our community. And yes, 17 family members may have come from that small town, but were they illegal immigrants? And does it matter? Does it matter? They died. We wrapped their homes in plastic. And then we burnt them to death. Does it matter whether they were illegal or not? They were human beings. And just going back on to kind of who the community are, we are, some of you I'm sure have been to Notting Hill Carnival. We are vibrant, we are multicultural, we are strong, and we've strengthened since Grenfell. But we have always fought for our services. We fought for our libraries, we fought for our creches, we fought for all of these things. Recently, a bit of our public land, which used to be a Citizens Advice Bureau, was sold off, and that is now a prêt-à-manger. And the other side, which I think they've halted due to the pure protests. We protest in a funny way, I'm not going to get into that. But that was going to be sold off as a £6,000 term prep school, which no one in the north of the borough can really afford. But none of that is in the media, none of that, none of the fights, none of the fact that we've got every Friday, we've got people and bongos out there singing songs, saying don't stop going to prep, and stuff like that. Stop going to prep, not don't stop going to prep. But none of that's shown. All that's shown is the crime or the fact that within the weeks following the fire, we had some very angry young people who'd never seen, and none of us had ever seen anything like that night, but had no one to direct their trauma at, no one to speak to their anger at. These are predominantly young black and Muslim men, and they are predominantly the ones who were there that night. You know, they were the ones that woke people up. They were the ones that ran into the building, screamed, tried to get people out. Yet they've been portrayed in a way, yes, they're angry, so they've, I don't know, shouted at council in the middle of the street and then been pulled into a police cell. I don't know really where to go from here, but
I mean, I think you're raising issues. I know Karim's got things to say about it, but look, you're also raising issues about the way that the local infrastructure actually, since the fire, has been decimated. And I know that feeds into some of the issues, so maybe you could say something about your experience.
Yeah.
So I think there's been three main waves of criminalization of young Muslim men in Albert Grove, to be honest. I'll develop it a little bit further, but I think the first one was demonstrations which took place 2008, early 2009, in another part of the borough outside the Israeli embassy. You had at least tens and possibly over 100 young men from Lambert Grove arrested during that protest movement outside the Israeli embassy, and the sentences and ways they were dealt with in the court system were massively, massively different to the way it's other people who've been arrested during those demonstrations were. The second massive criminalisation that took place in Albert Grove was the riots. You had a large section of young people who were literally just sent into prison very, very quickly. And then the third one was, of course, ISIS. Now, it's known that Albert Grove, because of the corporate media and the way that it's depicted it, has had an interesting relationship with all of these things. But the point is that the demonisation of and exactly as Tasha said, when we were out there on the street watching it and being blocked by riot police from getting close to the building and stuff, everyone were, to be honest, almost all of the people were young Arab people, you know, to be honest. So it's interesting the way that then the demonization that the community has faced has been built upon in the way that Grenfell's happened. If we look at who has actually gone to prison off the back of Grenfell, there was a gentleman who was confronted with the absolutely horrifying situation of a dead body put outside his front door in one of the blocks next to Grenfell. Now, it was the body of somebody who had jumped from the tower. Now, upon seeing that, and as he said in interviews later when he was frankly interrogated by Newsnight about why he did it, he said, in normal situation, there would never be any need for me to film what had happened. But in this situation, I needed people to know that I had literally my front door being blocked by a dead body. He filmed that body. What happened? Within a few hours, he was contacted by a journalist who asked him for the footage. He went to meet that journalist, and the journalist had conspired with the police to arrest him. He did 3 months in prison. The point is this. During the riots, you had 24-hour courts, right, for people to go to prison for nicking ice cream cones and bottles of water. We have not seen any of the people that we know. We have not seen Rockfield and Mellon, who directly was responsible for the decision to change from non-flammable zinc cladding, which the community wanted, to this wretched stuff that was chosen. We haven't seen, as far as I know, them be arrested, let alone interrogated. You've had people from the area, it's a suspended sentence, but he was arrested for them finding cannabis oil in his flat. Survivor of Grenfell, during forensic studies of the building, they found traces of cannabis oil, and he was given a suspended sentence. Right. We have seen the plethora of cases of quote-unquote Grenfell fraudsters, when, you know, the whole point of them being fraudsters in this situation is that they're not actually related to Grenfell, but yet that word is put in that proximity. At the same time, the corporate media will peddle the idea of the ISIS connection between four roads within a stone's throw of each other in Albert Grove, at the same time when the community is dealing with what they're dealing with. So I think that's really an important part of it, but exactly as you said, you know, this criminalisation, it serves a purpose. It's not random, it's not for it serves the wider trend of really moving people, you know, and social cleansing also.
Thank you, Karim. Look, I think we also have to contrast that with exactly what the police did when they were investigating who everyone knows are the chief suspects here. The Tenants Management Organisation and Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council, they didn't even get in touch with them for 5 weeks. And after 5 weeks, they sent a letter saying, we will be in touch in due course. And of course, that's 5 weeks of lost evidence, 5 weeks when they kind of cover up the Joes talking about can go on. I mean, I think we'll come on to maybe thinking about talking about the possibility of justice here in a moment. I just wanted to ask Joel if you wanted to come back on any of these issues about the impunity of council officials. Can we even do something, some work around that?
A couple of points. I mean, I think one of the issues here is that the framework in local governments is such that we don't really do a good job of monitoring conflicts of interest between elected officials and various kind of roles they might have. So, you know, Pilgrim, you mentioned working for a planning consultancy as a council. How might that affect your decision to approve a particular development? Do you personally benefit? We don't do a very good job at all of kind of tracking these things. So, as an example, if you were, say, a politician somehow related to Vladimir Putin, and you wanted to transfer money into the UK, there's what's called politically exposed persons regulation, which would basically flag up to the bank that you were a person of interest, you might have political connections, you're likely to be at risk, and therefore the bank should do a high level of checks to kind of make sure you're doing it above board. There's no equivalent for local authorities. So if you're a council leader, or if you're a council finance officer, if you're a member for finance or planning, you might have to declare some of your interests on a form, which gets supposedly kind of checked every 12 months, but no one actually looks at it. Those forms aren't collectively published anywhere. And a lot of these officials do huge amounts of corporate kind of schmoozing. So going back to Tom Fairhead at Kent Hill and Chelsea Council, I put an FOI request for his conflict interest form and found out that he'd been basically going to football matches funded by HSBC. Had been seeing most of the major big banks around London over his time at the council there. And this is just one council, this goes on all over the place. I think there's an article just this week showing that across London there was 100 local authority councillors who had relationships with planning consultancies. So these people make enormously important decisions about regeneration, about how infrastructure works in our communities, and yet they're subject to, a lot of kind of corporate lobbying, and as citizens, we don't really have any oversight for this. It's not any scrutiny, and it's very hard to hold them accountable. And that's just not at the council level, it's also the people who are supposed to provide oversight to the councils. There's a thing called the Audit Commission, which used to scrutinise local authorities and audit their accounts. That was shut down in 2015 as part of the cuts. And the work of the Audit Commission, which would have looked at and scrutinised things like the KCTMO, that was transferred to big four audit companies like KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Now, KPMG were basically the auditor of Ryden, the auditor of Arconic and Salatex, yet KPMG were deemed by the UK government to be an appropriate party to actually advise the Grenfell Tower inquiry. And so a few of us here wrote a letter wrote and complained about this and said, look, it's an enormous conflict of interest. There's no way KPMG, given its close involvement with the likes of Ryden, should be anywhere near that inquiry. And thankfully, they saw sense and basically withdrew over a weekend after articles published in the FT and the Guardian. So I think this issue around kind of conflicts of interest and holding elected officials accountable is enormously important, and it doesn't get near enough attention in the media or by communities and citizens at large. So I think it's something we can all pay a bit more attention to.
Thanks, Joel. I think we're going to go to the audience. I mean, there are issues we need to come back to around, what needs to be done in the community in the here and now, but maybe we could go to the audience for some questions and input. There's a couple of mics, so if you could put your hand up clearly if you want to ask a question. I can see two over here. Let's get that one with the mic. Yeah.
My question really is about
in the context of justice, and I've been to many talks about like say Steve Toombs, who talked about the idea of asbestos in the environment and who might have been down there casually and might end up some kind of lung issue, etc. And any other things you can think of. What does, for an anti-carceral feminist, what does justice look like in the context of what we're facing with Brownfell? Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Can I take maybe three questions and then we'll go to the panel? So I saw somebody here.
Isn't there a danger that it's an unfortunate use of language that Grenfell being a torch would be flagged up by the establishment as something, an anomaly, something that we're not, you know, really like used to dealing with? In actual fact, 72 children have probably already died with maybe asthma related diseases within social housing within the last 12 months that we wouldn't know about, so, you know, dodgy gas boilers, etc. And just areas where, you know, living within them, where they've been abandoned by state, they've been abandoned by police, they've been abandoned by councils, and where generally, the standard of living is not anything that anyone would ever choose. So there's a danger, there's something that the establishment are going to hold up as a torch. The establishment doesn't give us inquest or inquiries to give us justice. They do that in order to make us negate the truth and to give us something that they can put in a bubble and say we've delivered something. But I ultimately believe that this is going to be used as a flag to distract us from the wider issue, and that's what they want us to do.
To deal with, that they weren't put at risk,
that they weren't treated with contempt. So I think the change has, I think the justice has to be found socially, and I think it's more likely to be found socially in a sense than our current sort of system for public inquiries or through the criminal justice system. And I think in terms of Grenfell as an anomaly, I think we just keep on, in my mind, it's always linked. Grenfell was just a sort of intense, sort of spectacular example of what is going on all the time in terms of the harm that the system that we're living in causes us and the people who are actively encouraging that are causing to other people.
Would you like to respond to any of those questions?
Struggling with the first one. I think change. I think a complete overhaul of building regulations and legislation. And I think we need to look at social housing. I think we need to look at privately owned buildings. I think we need to look at communities. I am struggling with the first question because for me, someone who lives near the tower and someone who witnessed what happened that night, someone has to pay for that. And someone has to go to prison for that. Because, you know, our friends burnt in that building, and I'm not going to let that go. And I understand that we all have different kind of views on the world and we all see justice in a different way, but personally, I want someone to go down for killing 72 people, over 40 children. That's not. And I'm not prepared for it just to become a desk man, for it to be passed down, passed down, passed down. And I know that as soon as they hand someone to us, we've got to challenge that and figure out, I don't want someone who's, you know, sat behind a computer necessarily taking the fall for it, but I do want someone to go down for this, and I want people to learn, because maybe if someone does get a hefty sentence, if they're fine the hell out of them, whatever they do, maybe then the next time people will think before they make decisions that will cost lives, and that's what I hope.
Sorry, what was that?
She's got her back.
Oh, she's got you back.
Thank you!
One, two. Okay. So I just wanted to speak to the comment that was made about asbestos, and this hasn't seemed to have been massively publicised, but a week after it happened, we received a letter from the council suggesting we get air purifiers inside our houses. Of course, at our expense, not at their expense. But then that was later retracted, which is interesting as well. You know, what were they doing there? What were they trying to cover themselves for, leaving, etc.? For my sins, if you were to come to the area in 2012 and come to the football pitches, partly the football pitches that were demolished for refurbishment, you would find me there wearing a T-shirt that had a massive RBKC emblem on it. Now, at that time, I was working as part of the weekly football sessions we have on Mondays and we have on Fridays with the young people in the area. I also volunteered in the youth centre in the area, which was brought under the control of a company called Epic, prioritised basically at first, and they were put into a situation where they had to meet quotas of AQAs that they were producing. Some people that would have an AQA, whether it was in boxing, or it was in cooking, or it was in sound engineering and stuff like that. And I remember being in the meetings, and it was really this kind of slow grind of bureaucratic violence whereby, you know, people's jobs were dependent upon their ability to meet this you know, just manufactured quota, essentially. The point is that those football sessions, I remember getting to know some of the young people. And just about 2 weeks ago, I was coming back about 11:30, and Whitstable House, which is the block that is, it's like adjacent to Grenfell, shall we say. I saw a police car pull over very sharply, and I thought, I'm going to go over there and just see what's going on. It's literally about 30 yards from my door. I went over, and one of the young people I know from the area, he said, look who it is, you know him. And on the floor was one of the young people that I had been working with, not just through the youth centre, but also through the football sessions. Of course, the football sessions were cut, the youth centre was privatised. The youth centre was shut when Grenfell happened, but the people that used to work there opened it up in order to receive donations. Since then, you know, it's been guarded almost 24 hours because it's been sent off to the private school next door to it by, you know, someone most likely in 0 hours contract. You know, the donations that are in there are not being given back to the community. But anyway, back to the story of Whitstable House. And I see on the floor, it's this young boy who's been stabbed 3 times. And the point is that in that situation, we had my neighbour's daughter called the police and the ambulance. When she called the ambulance, they asked if he was black and if the people that stabbed him was black. Not only that, I'm there holding this boy's hand, and you know, we're waiting for the ambulance, and police are coming. Gradually, more and more police are coming. Now, at the beginning, they're fairly cooperative, but as time passes, they start to become a little bit more abrasive. When the ambulance comes, they actually threaten to arrest us, and they tell us, F off, this is a crime scene, or you're going to be arrested. So we're in a situation where we're saying to them, we know him personally. It will make him more comfortable for us to be around personally with him. The really interesting thing about the police is that when they were in communication with the ambulance, is they were saying, it's at Grenfell Tower. It's not at Grenfell Tower. It's not. It's Whitstable House. The ambulance speeds past us towards Grenfell Tower. We go out into the street and have to chase down the ambulance to come towards us. So we see the ways in which the violence of austerity leads to these situations, whether it's the ambulance coming late. You know, and there was a situation in Portobello Road in 2017 where a young man bled to death because the ambulance took too long to come in the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. Or it's the situation of on a Monday and Friday night, it was a Saturday night, but on a Monday and Friday night, this young man would be playing football with us. He wouldn't be in these kind of situations. It's a whole cultural ambience that is created that pushes in different ways, pushes and pulls people towards different things. One thing I was going to say about the way that injustice within this context functions is it functions in this incremental way. So there's incremental injustices. And it, by the same token, I am a believer in incremental victories at the same time and daily victories that are not necessarily kind of seen or emphasized or glorified in any way, shape, or form, but they do exist, and you know, people are making them happen. So, you know, in terms of justice, I don't know. I mean, there's no real semblance of justice in this situation, full stop, really. But I think there is reparation. There is, and if we can reverse this asset stripping culture, if we can find a way to, you know, it's about the micro meeting the macro, and the way that we can force that shut, you know. These councillors and these MPs need to realise from the last election what it illustrated clearly is that neoliberalism is nowhere near as electable as it once was. I see it as unelectable. And so we need that to be kind of communicated clearly, especially to the kind of Blairite councillors, etc. They need to see that this is unelectable. You know? So that's what I'm saying.
It's a non-punitive justice point. I mean, I'll just say, basically, if you're rich, if you're white, that's basically the system we already have, right? So we have a two-tier justice system where if you're a particular class, laws don't apply to you. If you're poor, if you're black, you'll get sent down for exactly the same thing. So, I mean, I don't know what the solution here is in terms of those responsible for Grenfell. I guess what I'd like to see is, you know, let's have Sajid Javid, Rockfielding Mellon, Gavin Barwell told they have to sleep in a fire unsafe hotel block. You know, let's see how long it takes to fix the regulation of that procedure. I mean, you know, for the weeks after Grenfell, I couldn't help think what it must be like for all those people who were living in Tower Box thinking that could have been me, and here we are almost a year later and literally nothing has changed. We have a system of impunity where those in power are completely above the law. I guess in terms of things we should be talking about, I think, you know, restoring legal aid is absolutely vital. In terms of and I think, you know, we really need to be talking about policy and legislative change. So, yeah, Grenfell has to be a never again moment. We need to see urgent change to building and safety regulations, and instead the rhetoric coming out from politicians is, oh, maybe there'll be a few tweaks to building regulation. Not a wholesale departure from deregulation, no, a few tweaks. So I think we're going in completely the wrong direction, and we need much more sustained public pressure. And I think we need to be committed to a kind of long fight to get there.
I think there's one thing to reflect on. We may come to it if we've got time, but one thing to reflect on in relation to Sam's question about justice. Look, there probably will be a corporate manslaughter prosecution. Maybe there won't be, right? But I think it's likely there will be. But there are two things to say about that. One is, when the legislation was framed, and Hilda knows about this because the Hazards campaign fought tooth and nail to make sure that senior managers, directors, could be prosecuted for that offence. Individuals can't be prosecuted for that offence. Only a faceless organisation can be prosecuted for that offence. In this context, it means Kensington and Chelsea Borough Council. And what that means is if they get a large fine, the fine will simply be distributed in the way that Joel explained. And actually, council taxpayers will probably pay for it. So I mean, that's one way of actually reinforcing the fact that we're actually a long way from that level of justice. Anyway, I see one question here, and can I just take, I saw the two at the front, so can I take those three and then we'll have to kind of end it there. I'm really sorry. Please.
Firstly, I'd just like to thank the panel. It's been incredibly moving this evening. I think in the face of this type of thing, I tend to feel quite powerless, and I wondered if you had any advice that just some really practical steps that I as an individual could take to help justice with Grenfell.
I'd just like to say thanks to all of the panel for coming along and really informing us about what's going on and where it needs to go. This is about gentrification, ethnic and social cleansing. That's their intention with all the big cities in this country, to just run people out who are fourth, fifth, sixth generation. So people need to be made aware of that. Another thing that hasn't been mentioned, which is very important, the fire started in a fridge that had plastic back. And most people in this room may have a fridge with a plastic back, myself included. And nobody told us. In America, you cannot buy a plastic back fridge. They're all metal backs. When your fridge goes on fire, it releases toxic smoke. It's like a gas. And that rises above the smoke. So sometimes the smoke does not hit your smoke alarm. Who knew? We know about this now. So people need to go home and check all the dangerous appliances that this government allowed to be passed so that the private companies can make as much profit as possible. They don't care who dies. They're not interested. It's about the feral elite making as much money as possible, murdering. It shouldn't be corporate manslaughter. It should be murder. Because when you make cladding that's flammable, what is your intention? To make profit to the detriment of the people out there.
Plays in what's happening right now, because the dehumanisation of the people who are living in and around that area, it starts with the way you're described as a big problem and as a crisis, and I'm seeing this happening with knife crime in London. I was like, wait a minute, you know, these things have been going on for years, and now it's been described as a crisis. And the thing is that when something's described as a crisis, it's often the first step in responding to it in a way which is often really dehumanising. It's often the first step to withdrawal of services, withdrawal of support, and labelling people. It's the same that we've done with the refugee crisis. And now we're in a situation where we've got people who are living in unsafe conditions, where we're throwing people on the street who've had horrific experiences and have come here for help. So just wanted to flag that up. Be wary when you hear people being described as a problem, as a crisis, because that is the next step.
Thank you. And then I think your contribution speaks directly to the point Karim made, and I want to underline this because I find it astounding to hear a story where somebody's phoning up because they're potentially dying and they're asking for an ambulance. The ambulance is asking whether you're black or not, and that's going on in London in this day and age, and it's connecting exactly to that language that you're talking about, the racist language that's used to describe those communities, whether it's for knife crime, you know, or wherever it is, whatever it is. So I'll take that as a comment, and maybe there are two points to address to the panel. One is, look, deregulation is affecting all of us in our homes.
Yes.
And also maybe because we want to come to a kind of closing discussion about what needs to happen next, that's a good question to end on. What steps can we take? And I'll maybe start at this end of the panel, if that's okay with you, Tasha.
So yeah, go home and check your fridges, I would say, as well. What's really interesting with Grenfell is, I mean, the toxins obviously from the fridge would have been released immediately, but the firefighters put that fire out, it was out, and they left the flat, and they went outside and they turned around and the building was on flames. So it was a spark that had kind of got behind one of these panels and the whole building went up. So I wouldn't say if you live in a tower block now and you've got a plastic back fridge to go home and freak out, don't do that, that's the last thing you should do. But I would just be very aware that a lot of these things that are here to serve daily purposes for us are often the things that might kill us. That's something to keep in your mind. What can you do practically? I think the big thing I would say is, as I said before, just keep talking about it. Just make sure that it's in everyone's conversation. And this kind of leads on to the second point, is humanise these people. And one thing that we do at every solidarity march we have around the UK is we send off pictures of the 72 victims, because they were people. So as much as you can humanise them and tell their stories and research, go and have a look at local groups. For example, we've got Solidarity Sports, who work with vulnerable children, and they lost two of their children in the fire, and they've made these beautiful videos about the kids. Now go and share those videos. Tell people that this young girl, Firdaus, who died when she was 12 years old, could have been the next Prime Minister. Listen to her speak and relay that and show that video to someone else. I would say come to, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this just yet, but it hasn't been revealed, but keep an eye out for our next demo that's happening in the next kind of, well, around the anniversary mark, and come down and let them know that we're still angry about this and we're not gonna forget. And spend the day with us and then come back to the area with us, come to the tower, meet the community, come and get involved in some of the events that we'll have happening. Come and speak to people, learn firsthand the struggles that people are still facing, and then come back and tell that to someone else. And keep that story going. Keep writing to newspapers, keep writing to your MPs until someone prints what you've written, or your MP says in Parliament a little bit of what you've written to them about. Just keep at it, keep at it, keep at it, because we can't do it alone. Our community has been through so much, and yes, we're strong, but we're all, you know, it takes its toll, and we need people from outside to come in at sometimes and say, hey, we're so angry about this, we're not going to let this go, because otherwise we just look like an angry community. And we are, but we need you all to be really angry too, and we need you to support us with this. It's not going to be a quick fight. It's not going to be as long of a fight as we had with Hillsborough, but it's not going to disappear overnight, and we need you just to stay angry with us, please.
I'll just say something briefly. The KPMG campaign, which I think, I'm correct in saying Joel was heavily involved with, that was successful, and that's important, because I think that with the kind of violence of neoliberalism hides in the ambiguity, it hides in these spaces and these little crevices where indifference and distance can be maintained. So I think that we should look at the ways in which different campaigns have been victorious and really build on that and kind of apply that to new ways of resisting and new techniques.
A lot of what this points to is a democratic deficit right across society, both at the local level and certainly at the national kind of political level. And, you know, like, democracy is like a muscle, we need to kind of exercise, we need to use it. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to kind of get more involved, primarily at the local level, because that's where, at least I personally believe, change is more likely to happen. But, you know, get involved in our communities to put pressure on elected officials, scrutinise people to hold them to account and to basically educate ourselves to, you know, to do better. On the sort of point about dehumanisation, I think one of the things I sort of observed around the sort of London riots in particular was the relationship between the closure of the youth centres and people kind of warning at the time that was going to kind of relate to, you know, short-term kind of social problems and what happened sort of subsequently with the riots. And I think, unfortunately, what's happened, we've allowed a banking crisis to be transformed into something which has allowed us to allow elites to justify a withdrawal of the social welfare state, and we can't allow that to continue. We're giving away too much. So let's not allow, you know, debt and austerity to be used as tools to destroy society. We need to get out and fight for that, and we need to invest in a humanising society.
Yeah, I mean, I think in addition to what's already been said, I think something we can do, which is what somebody from Hazard's campaign said earlier, and that is linking up our campaigning work. And so finding the commonalities between what happened in Grenfell and in other campaigns, and geographically as well. I mean, these are common issues, but they're not often, you know, housing movement particularly is often not joined up between different cities. So I mean, I'll just take this opportunity. There's a housing justice event being organised here. I think it's next weekend on the 11th and 12th. And that will be linking up housing campaigners from this city with some really excellent housing campaigners in London. So the main people who've been organising street homeless people and so on. And I think then there's some harder things to do about dehumanising, but I think something we managed to do, and I hope we continue, not so much has been done of this recently, it certainly was done and was very, very helpful those first few months after the fire, and that is showing the humanity of those people themselves and amplifying those voices and giving those people the skills and the confidence to sit in front of a camera and show people that they are intelligent, deserving human beings. And that makes it very, very difficult for you to dehumanise somebody who's just heartfeltly explaining what their situation is, how they actually don't want to be in a hotel. They would far rather be in a house where there was just enough space for their kid to play. And so for me, I think that's something that I try and do is amplify those voices and give them the sort of confidence and the skills, and don't always rely on the political leaders or the people who are always speaking on behalf of other people. Because I actually think that's how we get our message across far, far better, is having real people who are really affected by the issues, but who are supported and able to communicate it with people. Because I think people become sort of distant from familiar political faces, and I think that it is much more impactful if you know, and people can tell and they can feel that this is a real mum, you know, who is living in a hotel with a tiny kid who can't play, you know. And so that's kind of what I try and do, and I think that's the way, for me, I think that's the way politics has to go. It has to really go down and outwards and really include the people, and instead of political people thinking perhaps about their careers or profiles or egos, is that we look down and we spread that out and we think about power, about what it means to really share that power. And I think that will then have its own sort of consequences, because I think you'll have people who are genuine speaking to other people, you know, and I think that kind of comes across. But yeah, there's a housing justice event going on here in Liverpool on the 11th and 12th, and I think that's going to be really, really good. So, and that will be leading up different campaigns, including some of the people involved in Grenfell campaigning with campaigners here in Liverpool.
We've got the resources for that event, so I'll make sure they're on the table if we can have a little space on the table so you can pick out it's at the Friends Meeting House. Look, there is going to be an ongoing press discussion about this. The inquiry, the public inquiry, is due to open on the 21st of May. I tend to think what we've heard from the panel here is going to be much more important than the public inquiry, because already we're seeing the signs of a stitch up. The core participants, the several issues there, the 28 of the 28 organisations that are core participants, 18 of them are private companies, many of them the manufacturers that were named by Green and Joe. Only one trade union, the Fire Brigade Union, because they couldn't avoid including the Fire Brigade Union. I don't know if hazards applied, they're not there. Justice for Grenfell, we're not allowed to be core participants, so that sinks already as a so-called public inquiry, all kinds of other issues. So that means we have to be looking to what's going on in the streets, or what Green talks about as the incremental victories and new other ways of linking up and thinking about how we act politically. And I'm sure that will come. I'm sure there'll be people in this room who are committed to supporting. Look, I'm tying this up just by saying thanks to everyone on the panel. All of the members of this panel do this in their own time. It's incredible, actually, what they do. And all of the members of the panel speak their head about the panel that are incredibly brave. And I have to say, the bravest are the two members of the panel who still live in the community and have to live through this on a daily basis. So we have to be very grateful to them and to all the members of the panel. I also want to thank everyone here, because it's a big turnout, and it's a big turnout of support. It's been a great discussion, so thanks for you. Does Madeline need to make